It's the Friday edition of Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. We remember Michigan Statehood Day later this hour. That will be commemorated in downtown Lansing tomorrow. And we have a very special guest for that segment. Ernst Floeter has been living in mid-Michigan for well over five decades. But on June 6th, 1944, he was a member of the German Army and was at Normandy on D-Day. And so he has led an extraordinary life, ended up settling here in the Lansing area, and we will hear his story in the context of what is going on at the State Historical Museum later this hour. We also have live music for you today. Matt Borgie on keyboards and Mike Teeger on saxophone. They are an East Lansing-based duo who create ambient music, and we will be hearing from them. They'll be playing for us, and we'll be talking to them later this hour. We hope you can stick around. At the top of the show, incumbent U.S. Congressman Mike Rogers will have a Democratic opponent when he runs for re-election this November. Our next guest, Ken Darga, says he expects he has thrown his hat in the ring this year against Rogers in the solidly Republican 8th District. Mr. Darga is stressing he's moderate on the issues. In fact, on his campaign website, he lists reasons Democrats should vote for him and separately offers a list of reasons Republicans should vote for him. The Lansing resident retired as Michigan's demographer last year after 22 years in that position. He is an economist who, prior to his role as demographer, worked at the Department of Management and Budget. And we welcome Ken Darga to Current State.
Thank you for having me on the show.
What's compelling you to run, Ken?
Well, I'm concerned about America's future if we don't bring back manufacturing. Thinking back to World War II, which is a theme of the show, America's manufacturing was a very important part of winning that war. Mm-hmm. We were able to convert our civilian factories to military purposes and keep our civilian economy going.
Mm-hmm.
Someday, I don't know when, there will be something that interrupts traffic across the ocean. It's going to be very hard for cargo ships to make it thousands of miles across the ocean safely. And
what do you anticipate there? What would interrupt traffic?
Well, it could be a major war. It could be a trade embargo. But we are very highly dependent on materials from the other side of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of our computer equipment, electronics, energy efficient light bulbs, a lot of things we need for the civilian economy could be potentially denied to us if we get into a situation where we need to convert our factories to military purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Those factories are going to be on the other side of the ocean. And someone else will be converting them to military purposes.
And you view a revival of U.S. manufacturing as a key step in improving our trade balance as well. I know that's
exactly
very important to you. Tell
yes.
us a little bit more about how those two are related.
Well, when a nation is buying more from other countries than it sells, that means that the nation's income is going to fall short of its spending. No, there's no way around that. That just follows directly from the definition of national income. So as long as we have a trade deficit, someone is going to have to be spending more than their income. It can be the government or it can be consumers.
And right now our trade deficit is in the neighborhood of 30-some billion dollars a month, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. It's a huge, mind-boggling number.
Yeah.
And now, we saw a few years ago what happens when consumers are spending more than their income. Now we have the government spending more than their income. No, that's a symptom of something seriously wrong. And what it's a symptom of is the trade deficit.
You're stressing very much the fact that you're a moderate Democrat and you're actively reaching out for Republican votes. Why this emphasis on moderation?
Well, if you look at the distribution of opinion in the country, Gallup does a poll every year asking people to rate themselves from conservative to liberal. you basically get a bell-shaped curve. Now, the largest category is people who consider themselves moderates. But if you look at Congress, moderates are hardly represented at all. Political scientists have done an analysis of the distribution of liberals and conservatives mm-hmm. in Congress, and what you get is two bell curves with a big gap in between.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of conservatives, you have a lot of liberals, but moderates are unrepresented. And it's the moderates who can communicate well with both sides, appreciate the concerns of both sides, and develop compromises because, you know, that's exactly the policy that a moderate believes in.
Do you borrow from both parties' playbooks regarding the policies that you are backing? I mean, are there policies associated with the right, for example, that you support, even though you're a Democrat?
Well, I think that the key to bringing back manufacturing is improving America's business climate and taking a lot of overhead costs away from employers. So I think that I have perhaps the best pro-business agenda in the nation, and that's what it takes to bring back manufacturing. But as a Democrat, I also have a priority on helping business in a way that also helps workers and consumers.
Does being a moderate Democrat seeking Republican votes mean you're open to, say, a balanced budget amendment?
I think that we should have a balanced budget because an imbalanced budget is a symptom of something seriously wrong with the economy. But I think that a balanced budget amendment is a very bad idea. It's basically saying, let's cut back on our medicine without fixing the underlying problem. I'm very strongly committed to moving toward a balanced budget, but the way to get there is by fixing the economic imbalances that cause the federal deficit. No, the number one imbalance is the trade deficit. No, as long as we're buying more than we're selling, we're going to be going into debt.
Have a problem. We're talking with Ken Darga, who formally announced yesterday that he is a Democratic candidate for the for Michigan's 8th district, and he hopes to be taking on Mike Rogers here come November. Regarding reform of political finance, you say organizations don't have all of the same rights as individuals, or shouldn't have all the same rights as individuals. On your website, you say, quote, Congress should prohibit the use of funds for political purposes that individuals have not freely contributed for political purposes. Tell us more about that position.
Okay. Well, corporations don't serve in the military. Corporations don't vote. So there are various things that human people do that corporate people do not. And I think that one of those should be spending money for political purposes. I have no problem with political action committees where individuals contribute money to an organization, and then the organization acts politically on behalf of those individuals. But I do have a problem with money that I spend as a consumer being used for political purposes mm-hmm. that may run counter to what I believe.
What's the best approach to health care? And how do you feel about the Affordable Care Act?
I think the Affordable Care Act is several steps forward, but something that Democrats and Republicans can both agree on is that it has a lot of room for improvement.
And how would you propose improving it?
I think the biggest improvement that we should work toward is taking health care costs away from employers so that they are no longer a factor that discourages companies from having workers in America. If you're doing long-term planning and deciding where to build a factory, You can look at the historical increase in healthcare expenses and extrapolate that into the future and say, well, America is not the place that I want to have my workers. And that's one of the reasons why so many of our factories are being built by American companies overseas, and so many American companies are outsourcing work to foreign countries, you know, because of healthcare costs. So we need to find a way to take that burden away from employers so that it's not considered a cost of doing business in America.
Tell me, how has the state Democratic Party organization responded to your candidacy? Have you spoken with Lon Johnson, for example, the head of the party?
Not with Lon Johnson, but I have spoken with Garrett Arwa, the executive director of the party, and with several other people at the state party and the the county party chairs. And
are they supportive? Do you feel like they're supportive of your candidacy?
Of course, they're not able to make an endorsement, so I don't want to imply any endorsement. But I think that I've had cordial meetings with the state Democratic Party, and I've gotten a lot of good advice and assistance.
Are you counting on much support from them? This is a heavily Republican district. And money is invariably involved in the campaign.
Uh-huh. Well, money is going to be hard to come by from the party, because this is not currently considered a race where the Democrats have a probability of winning. There are several races that have been identified as priorities, and this is not yet one of them. I hope to change that.
Do you expect a competitor in the August primary?
Yes, I do. There is another candidate who is seriously considering running.
And that is?
Susan Grettenberger.
Okay.
She is a social work professor at Central Michigan University who lives in Lansing.
From talking with you and looking at your website, you're fairly critical of special interest groups. But if you yourself are too moderate, doesn't that jeopardize support you arguably might need from traditionally Democratic special interests, say the MEA or the AFL-CIO?
Well, there's a reason why moderates are underrepresented in Congress, and that is that even though a moderate can have a good chance of winning a general election, the first step is to win a Democratic primary or a Republican primary. And in the primary race, it is an advantage to be more toward the left or more toward the right rather than toward the middle. And yet, it's the person from the middle who would have the best chance of winning the general election.
Very interesting. Well, we want to thank you for coming in here today and having the chance to talk with you. Ken Darga is the former State of Michigan demographer, and he has officially thrown his hat in the ring for the U.S. 8th District as a moderate Democrat. Ken, thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Live music here today on Current State provided by East Lansing's Matt Borgi on keyboards and Mike Teeger on saxophone. We'll be talking with Matt and Mike a little bit later on in the program. They have a new album of ambient music out called Convocation that is coming up here on Current State. On January 26, 1837, Michigan was admitted as the 26th state to the Union. The Michigan Historical Museum is celebrating our state's 177th birthday with its annual Michigan Statehood Day planned for tomorrow. The celebration is also centered around the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and there will be activities and guest speakers to commemorate the legendary World War II invasion. Joining us now to tell us more, Eric Perkins, a historian at the museum. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
And we're also pleased to welcome one of the guest speakers, Ernst Floater. Ernst is a Grand Ledge photographer who was at Normandy June 6, 1944, on the German side. He was later captured and was a prisoner of war here in the United States. Welcome, Ernst.
Welcome, thank you.
Eric, tomorrow, the 177th anniversary of Michigan statehood at the Historical Museum. You're also honoring the 70th anniversary of D-Day. It sounds like you have a lot planned.
Yes, we do. Yeah, it's we've started giving themes to Statehood Day. Last year we did the War of 1812. This year it's World War II and D-Day, the 70th anniversary. And it really are a lot of things planned. It tends to be a really big family event at the museum. Admission is free thanks to Jackson National Life. And we've got a lot of activities for kids going on, learning about code breaking during the war and aeronautics and airplanes. We have talking about paratroopers and a parachute drop they can participate in. And also we'll have costumed reenactors, living historians to show the gear and the uniforms and things. And well, of course, we have our veterans coming, some from Tuskegee Airmen Museum and Ernst and some others.
Very interesting. Sounds like a lot planned. And Ernst Floater of Grand Ledge, Michigan, you are one of those guest speakers tomorrow. I understand today is an anniversary for you as well. Tell us about that.
Last night, we arrived in New York 57 years ago, coming by airplane from Hamburg. And this morning, we found out that we have a sponsor in East Lansing, the All Saints Episcopal Church. So today we spend the day on Grand Central Station, and at night we started our journey towards Michigan by railway, and it was the same train schedule that I took as a prisoner of war in 1944 on the 12th of June.
January 24th, 1957, you arrived in East Lansing.
In East Lansing. We were sponsored by the church, and they were fantastically.
And you were at Normandy.
I was not direct on the beach, but I was about in the middle, by the town of Saint-Sauveur, and it was the regimental headquarters there. And we had no idea what was going on Omaha Beach. My impression was it's like a maneuver for the Allies coming into Europe, and we had no idea what this bloodbath on Omaha Beach.
How old were you?
18.
And what was your role in the Army?
I was radio man.
Radio man. Okay. And so you were how far from the actual invasion?
I was far away. We heard that the day before we heard some shooting in the distance there, but otherwise it was pretty quiet. And then that night when they told us, every night we had to watch the sky for additional 2 hours and looking out for paratroops.
Okay.
And that night they said, no watch tonight, and tonight they don't come. And then they came. Mm-hmm. And we were happy finally the wedding was over.
What was the collective mood of you and your fellow German soldiers prior to the actual invasion then?
Well, you never talked about anything, nothing political. You kept your mouth shut, because if you say a wrong word to a wrong guy, that was bad. So we never knew, and we had our little exercise every day too. But otherwise, it was pretty cool. We had the Ley Lions. Before Didi, I was a telephone man. We had to lay telephone lines all over the area there.
Okay.
And then on the sixth of June, we had to go out and cut all these lines, get ready for retreat.
Well, did you? Okay. So, were you confident that you could, assuming the Allies would invade, were you confident that you could withstand that invasion, or did you feel really vulnerable?
Well, I wanted to become a prisoner, go to America. That was my wish.
It was your desire to be vulnerable.
From 1939 on, when my father convinced me that Germany will not win the war, I made that silent wish. If I have to become soldiers, I want to fight against the British, get caught to get to Canada. That was my wish. And everything else from then day on was all what happened in my life, bad things, sickness, whatever, was all to this point to come as a prisoner of war to America. And heaven thanks, I was not caught by the British.
Okay, why so?
Well, the British, they were, I'm American, they were not my enemies. They were my friends. Enemies were the Nazis.
Okay.
And so I didn't want in the British. I've spent later on 4 days in England under the British. That was just enough.
But your wish was granted.
Okay.
You were taken prisoner.
I was prisoner, and everything came true. So if you have a wish in your life and you believe it, comes true.
we'll learn more about what happened after you were taken prisoner here in just a minute. Eric, back to you. What do we know about Michigan's role in World War II more broadly? I mean, I think a lot of people in Michigan are aware of the role, the fact that the Detroit auto factories played in manufacturing.
Sure.
But what else? How else would you describe Michigan's role in World War II?
Well, I think the manufacturing, obviously it's well known. You know, we think about automatically of the auto factories and things like that, converting their production. But what people don't realize is that effort was statewide. And it sucked in small towns as well as Detroit. I think of there's a little shop on Main Street in Yale, Michigan, which is a little town up north of Lapeer. And they had a little store there on their little Main Street. It was a jewelry store, and it was a jewelry and optometrist, watch repair, things like that. They converted that storefront to make precision machine bolts for bomber engines. And so there were all these smaller stories out there, Chris Craft making pleasure boats. Converted their production to make landing craft.
Hmm.
So they made all different size landing craft. And obviously, you know, a lot of times in Lansing, you know, we're landlocked, we don't think about the shipping that was made. Defoe Company in Bay City made a lot of ships and things like that. So it was a much wider effort, although 70% of Michigan's productive capacity was, you know, centered around Detroit.
It is interesting how this all played out in around the state. Mm-hmm. There's a little house not far from where I grew up in Ovid, mm-hmm. and I remember driving by this house one day with my dad, and he pointed out that we used to have plane spotters
in mid-Michigan
on the lookout for the Luftwaffe in Ovid, Michigan.
Yes, and Sault Ste. Marie.
Yeah, as well.
Protecting the locks was a huge thing.
Oh, I see. Strategically, of course.
Yeah.
Ernst, let's talk again about your capture. It happened not long after you didn't have long to wait.
No, 12 days after D-Day.
12 days.
I was liberated.
You view it as liberation.
Yeah.
How did that happen, though?
It was fantastic. It was a highlight in my life. we were a big group of 60 men and 8 officers. And we were marching, probably already caught up in the northern part of the Continental Peninsula. And then that noon, we were still, my commander was Major Sylvester von Salden. He was a regiment commander from 1057th Regiment. And he gave us the order, take cover. And in Normandy, they have these hedgerows.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like hedgerows all around us, and I bunked down under an apple tree, ate of my rations, and at night somebody pushed me. The Amish are here. The Amish Americans. So I crawled over to the head show right on that side, and then we waited there. And the Americans, they surrounded us, they shot over us, they hollered at us. It was a circus. It was unbelievable. And then at one of the German officers called out, stand up and shoot. But somebody pulled out his handkerchief or his towel and started to wave. And now out that corner came the first GI out. I dropped all my stuff, heaven thanks. No more rifle drills. That was my first idea.
You ended up in POW camps here in the United States then for nearly 2 years.
For 2 years.
Where were you?
We're in Fort Custer in Michigan, Camp Allen, Illinois, Camp Grant, Illinois, Fort Bliss, Texas, and then Hatch in New Mexico for 15 months. And then my last camp was Fort Eustis, was a school for democracy. Only anti-Nazis went to this camp. I think about 24,000 Germans, prisoner of war, went to this camp. It was a 60 course in democracy. We had every morning, we congregated in the big auditorium, and the German professors told us in German about something about America. So then after 6 days, we were let in the classrooms, and we had to fill the hand. Then they asked us questions. Why did Germany lost the war? Will Germany ever will have an army again? All those questions. Mm-hmm. So we had to answer those within a minute. And then we gave the script to somebody there, and next morning we congregated on a big square, and they called out the names, and my name too, so we made it.
And what else did you do as a prisoner of war, though? I understand you picked cotton in New Mexico.
I worked in Illinois, I worked in a corn cannery. Corn cannery in near Eureka, where President Reagan went to school. That was my camp.
Near where President Reagan went to school, right. Okay.
And then from there, we came to Camp Grant and worked in potato harvest for the Curtis Candy Company. And there we asked our guards what will happen with us. And they told us horrible stories about cotton picking, how hot it is, how hard it is.
So we ended up
we had a beautiful 3 days ride on the train from Illinois to El Paso. It was a beautiful train ride. And when I came to San Antonio, I said, I would like to live here.
How did you feel about, how did you look forward to the rest of your life during those years as a POW?
Well,
were you confident, generally confident about your future?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I had a good feeling. We all want to go back home. But then I lost all my home when it became Polish, my hometown. So finally, in July 1946, I was reunited with my parents.
And you ended up obviously back in the United States.
In 57.
From 46 to 57.
It was 11 years to make that dream come true to come back here.
I lived in
East Berlin for 7 years. On my wedding day, I snuck out of East Berlin and got married in West Berlin and became legal citizen of West Germany.
Eric, let's talk a little bit more about what's happening tomorrow at the Michigan State Historical Museum, mm-hmm. celebrating Statehood Day. You'll also have the Michigan Constitution pulled out and on display. Tell us about that.
Yes, you can. When folks come, they can see the first state constitution on display, and we actually have what's kind of neat. We have the tin tube it was in. They had it in a little bit of a tube, and it was there, so you can see that and the original document out on display. We will also feature the fragment, the only one remaining, of the Brady flag, which was considered by some to be the first state flag, mm-hmm. and it was a flag for a Detroit militia group called the Brady Guard in the mid-1830s, in the statehood period. They eventually became the Detroit Light Guard in Detroit, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
Ernst, have you ever revisited Normandy? Did you ever go back?
No, I always wanted to. I never went there. I got a picture here. That was when I came to Omaha Beach. I saw this.
Did you take this picture?
No, I didn't, but I got a big book was written by somebody watching, and there's this picture in that, and this, there I was as a prisoner of war.
Okay.
On that beach.
I've noticed you're very good with dates. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I got everything written down too.
You've got everything written down.
Yeah, but still.
And how was it you ended up settling here in the Lansing area?
Well, we were sponsored by the church in East Lansing, Saints, and we had no. It was in general a journey in the blue yonder. And you come here. I had the Bergen contract in my hand for an Episcopal minister on Long Island City in New York. And I wrote back, I don't want to go to New York, and New York is not America. I want to come to Michigan, Illinois.
Michigan,
that was my
America.
Wish, and it came true.
And how has this place treated you? How do you feel about the Midwest as opposed to other parts
Midwest.
Of the United States?
I had
States.
No complaint. I was a happy prisoner of war here. We had a much better life than as a German soldier.
You have a family?
I have a family. I got a wife and three children.
And you are a photographer, I understand.
I'm a photographer. I'm still in business, too, but not much to do right now.
How do you feel about today's Germany, Ernst?
Oh, well, I took in September my three kids to Germany. I'm the last of the Mohicans of my family. I have nobody else. But my wife has two sisters and kids. So we visit them all in West for 2 weeks. We visit them in North Germany, and then we went to Poland and showed my kids where I grew up in Stettin, northeast of Berlin. And then we went farther east where my wife came from.
Hmm. You left Germany before the Berlin Wall went up.
Oh, yeah.
What did the elimination of the wall mean to you?
Well, it was unbelievable. I always thought the wall will never come down. But I think the whole thing started with Lech Walesa, with the solidarity movement, that changed. But still, it was so much established, that wall in Berlin, that we said the wall never come down our lifetime.
Well, it's fascinating to hear your account. And once again, Ernst Floeder, former German POW who was held in American prisoner of war camps during World War II, will be a featured speaker tomorrow at the State Historical Museum. It is all a part of a look back at the 70th anniversary of D-Day, which is a part of Michigan Statehood Day tomorrow at the Michigan Historical Museum. Eric Perkins is the military curator at the museum. Eric, thank you. And once again, thanks to Ernst Floeder.
You're very welcome.
Best of luck. Thank you. You're listening to East Lansing-based ambient duo Matt Borgie and Mike Teeger on keyboards and saxophone, respectively. We'll be talking with Matt and Mike about their music coming up a little bit later on this hour here on Current State. That's coming to you live from Studio S here at WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. The North American International Auto Show continues through this weekend at Cobo Center. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Chevrolet Auto Show manager Misha Rawlings about some of the interactive exhibits available to auto show goers.
So what we give you the opportunity to do is to do a 10-second stop motion video featuring our vehicles, which get over 30 miles per gallon, and you might be surprised to know that one of those is Camaro.
Right.
So that's the one I picked on my adventure when I recorded it today. We give you the opportunity to pick kind of a location of where you would like to go with that vehicle, whether you'd like to go skiing in the snow or snowboarding, which is popular today, or if you want to go to the city. And then you kind of get to react to some of the things that you could do, and then you can share that video on Facebook, Twitter. You can email it to yourself and share it wherever you want. So it's just kind of a fun way to engage and kind of understand that we have quite a few vehicles that get over 30 miles per gallon.
Right. We both just had the chance to experience this where we were looking at, as you said, the car we drove, the environment we drove through, and then created the short stop motion video. And I didn't post mine to Facebook or send it as an email.
This one's fun to watch if you stand by and watch other people.
Misha, it really was a lot of fun to watch and fun to do as well. Another one of the activities that we just did was this Greenbrier van experience. Can you take us through sort of the look of this exhibit and activity and the vehicle that we actually sit in to have this video experience again?
So it's a 1963 Greenbrier that the auto show team that we purchased last year specifically for this activation.
Sort of a 1963 camper type vehicle.
It is.
Absolutely vintage and classic.
It is. We actually had a lot of people last year taking their photo with the vehicle, not just doing the engagement, which we have inside the vehicle.
Right.
So it's a pretty cool vehicle. And so what we have in the vehicle is basically you create a 7-second video, and while you wait, we turn that video into a flipbook that you and your friends can take away with you. We have a lot of fun props. We have sunglasses, hats, we have boas, kind of anything that you could imagine. And then you just get inside and you kind of play around for 7 seconds, and the flipbook is awesome. So this was something that was here in Detroit last year. This is where we introduced it a year ago. It was so very, very popular that we brought it back again this year. So
what I think is really fun is that you can sort of assume the 60s or 70s persona or character of your choice with some of the costuming options.
Correct. It's almost like you were just looking at my flipbook, because that's exactly what it's like. So it's a really fun experience for everybody.
I went for the Bootsy Collins look. How about you?
I think I had some, I kind of used a puppet in mine because I like color and a nice little boa and some crazy sunglasses. So
let's talk about my greatest failure today, which was the Chevy Corvette simulator. And this was a roller coaster ride, to say the least. And I'm not a big gamer myself. So if you've already got two strikes against you, like me, then you may not have great success, but it was a lot of fun. I got to say, it was a blast to kind of get a little bit of that Corvette experience through basically a very large screen video game.
Uh-huh, exactly. So this is, again, something that we brought back from last year. Only last year we had Gran Turismo 5. This features Gran Turismo 6, which just came out a couple of months ago. And these simulators were actually designed after the Corvette. We have Corvette seats actually in them. And it's just a really fun game to see how fast you can drive. We keep a leaderboard throughout the day to see whose time is fastest. So if you're really, really good, you might stay up there all day. I don't think I've ever been up there either year.
Misha, you've taken me through some of these interactive experiences today with Chevy. What are some of the other things that you do at the auto show?
Upstairs, we have an upper deck, so we have a motorsports area up there. Kind of, we tell that story up there about performance and motorsports and why we race, and how we take that technology and transfer it to the vehicles that you park in your driveway. So we have some vehicles upstairs. We have a couple of Indy cars. We have a NASCAR upstairs, and we have a couple of driver appearances next week, so we're going to have them signing autographs. If you happen to be here on one of those days, come by and see us. So,
Misha Rawlings at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. Misha, thanks so much for your help today.
All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Hey, is there any way you could talk for...
And we have one last story from the Detroit Auto Show on our website here today. Current State Scott Pohl has an update on the $299 million project to fix up Cobo Center. You can check that out at WKAR.org. Well, several times here previously in the hour, we have heard music live from Studio S. Matt Borgi on keyboards and Mike Teeger on saxophone. They both hail from East Lansing, and they have a new album of their ambient music out called Convocation, and they are part of our live music on Fridays, which has become a regular part of Current State. We really enjoyed it. Everybody loved the music.
Oh,
so,
thanks very much.
So we appreciate it an awful lot. You guys certainly have your own sound. What is the attraction with ambient music?
So this is Matt. You know, for me, the best part about ambient music is it's relaxing, and it's also contemplative music. It's a music that, sort of the father of ambient music in some ways is Brian Eno, who said it's a music that can be listened to as easily as ignored. But really and truly, it's a music you can be with. You can really be with the sounds. And so that's one of the reasons I really have been attracted to it, and you know, kind of coming up through traditional routes as a musician, it appealed to me early on, even before I had a name for it.
And Mike, how do you present your music live? Is it always, this is a pretty stripped down presentation and setup that you've got here in the studio.
Yeah, it's very bare bones for Matt today. Usually
yes.
He has the Starfleet Command Center that he's surrounded
well, it's
with.
It's the 30th anniversary of the Mac, so I just decided yeah. I was only going to do it with a laptop today. So.
Yeah, usually, so. As he said before, it's the ambient altar where he has, you know, guitar, a whole series of pedals, computers, and today it's just the computer. But usually live at his whole system, and then I just have a couple saxophones, maybe a flute, and then just go direct as far as sonically presenting it live. Live performance, this is not really a live type of music, and so one thing, a niche we've tried to enter in is being one of the few sort of live acts, because one thing you can do is just sort of show up and hit play on an iPod, you know.
I guess the subtext to my question is that ambient may actually be better suited to studio recording than to live performance.
Well, and that's true, but you know, one of the things I take it back to is sort of, I guess, for me, and when I've had those opportunities to truly enjoy a music, I think, you know, for us, the roots are probably in sort of a Western classical tradition, in that it's a music to be listened to. Mm-hmm. It's not about the show. It's not a showbiz kind of thing particularly. You go to listen. You enjoy the sort of being with others who have the same appreciation, but you really just sit and listen. And it's kind of a weird social perspective, but there's an audience for it.
The most successful live performances we've had have been more akin to a classical recital atmosphere as opposed to going to a club and watching us.
People
do it.
Really quietly, attentive.
Yeah, just
focus,
you know,
we
played a show in Philadelphia in October, and there were a couple hundred people there, and you could hear a pin drop the whole time.
Yeah,
they just sat and watched. Whereas, you know, if we, you know, play it, if we were to, you know, we played, I think, a Basement 414 once, and that was a close to a disaster in that, you know, we were playing and nobody really knew it because they were just sort of milling around, you know. And,
oh, boy.
Yeah.
And, you have to choose your venues carefully, I guess. It was the moral of that story.
Yeah, you do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on the other hand, too, I mean, you know, one of the pieces I definitely don't want to leave out is one of the things that brought, you know, Michael and I together as you musicians and performers was the fact that we both love improvisation, whether it's going back and, you know, talking about the work of the, you know, cadenzas that Beethoven had written to jazz through 20th century music. We're kind of introducing that sort of improvised ambient soundscapes as one of the way we talk about it. It allows it to live in the moment, but it also create that sort of contemplative environment for people to listen.
That takes that requires getting to know one another musically, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, how has that unfolded exactly?
It's a friendship, probably first and foremost. The fact that we have so many musical similarities, the fact that we ended up in the same sort of town. You know, kind of a funny story with, you know, you talk about the brain drain of people moving out of Michigan. Michael and I had been working together and playing in a band early on. And then his wife got a job teaching in Texas. And I was like, all right, well, that's it. So goes that. Well, in a coincidence, she landed a job teaching here in town, well, in mid-Michigan. And we now live about a mile apart. And, you know, it's like kind of a bit of a miracle in some ways.
It was meant to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it's great. I mean, now things were closer than ever, and that we had started to develop and we thought was lost when he moved away, you know, it's blossoming and flourishing. So.
Have you ever considered any visual elements to this, though? I mean, you've focused on how intently people listen to the music. Has there ever been a temptation to experiment with anything, say, visually?
Yeah, we have. These are conversations we've been having this week, actually. When we did that performance in Philadelphia that I mentioned, it wasn't really our plan, but we ended up using projection with that performance. And so there was photography going behind us, not of our choosing of that time, but right now we're putting a show together around town in May, and we're considering doing a whole projection visual component with that to give people a visual frame of reference.
Right.
Because, I mean, you can watch us, but very little exciting or showy happens. I mean,
Mike's pretty cool looking, but I got a face for radio. So,
yeah.
So I mean, you know, but yes, we have a show. I can't remember the day. I think it's this
Saturday, May 24th.
May 24th, we play in a scene Metro Space. But one of the things we've definitely come to, because we're used to kind of playing in places where we just go set up and do our thing. But with scene and that show we're going to do there, we are going to have projections. We're having projections specifically done for that show. May or may not actually have a live projectionist doing it. And we're tailor-making the space to this, what I'm calling a two-hour immersion performance. It's going to be an uninterrupted 120 minutes of music, because there's a long arc with this music. For those people who are interested in it, it's going to be something that we very rarely have here. East Coast, West Coast, absolutely. Just a little bit in Chicago, Michigan, next to never.
We're talking with Matt Borgi, who's a guitarist, and Mike Teager, a saxophone player. They're part of an ambient duo that's based here in East Lansing. How often is saxophone a part of ambient music? It seems I don't follow it closely, seems to me it's a less common instrument.
I'm learning that. Matt's been deep in the ambient world for a very long time, and I was aware of it peripherally, you know, as a musician before I met Matt. And there were, you know, I knew about Brian Music's, you know, ambient music series or whatever. But I just like playing with Matt. So I thought, I play saxophone, but who cares? I like playing with Matt. And then now being in that world and realizing that it's a very, not lonely place, but, you know, I'm a community of one, as far as I know, as far as, you know, saxophone players who play in that style of music.
Yeah.
And the illusions are always weird, like, well, you remind me of David Bowie because he made a record that was ambient friendly that had a saxophone on it. And it's like, well, David Bowie never really comes to mind when I'm playing, but that's an easy grab when people are saying,
sure.
Oh, it reminds me of that David Bowie record. It's
sure.
Like, okay, sure.
You know. You mentioned the May gig at Scene Metro Space.
Yeah, yeah.
Any other area performances we can talk about?
Well, we're going to be playing in Jackson at the Jackson Coffee Company February 22nd?
21st, I believe.
21st, I'm sorry.
And
that's going to be a bit of an ambient performance, but again, usually that's a venue that's suited towards acoustic music. And then most of our shows are out of town.
This type of music, like we have, you know, we've had successful performances in Philadelphia, but not so much so, you know, in Lansing or East Lansing.
Tough town for ambient.
Yeah.
You're going to play us out here. Tell us the track we're going to hear.
The tune we're going to hear next is off of our 2013 recording Convocation. It's called Discern Descent.
Discern Descent.
Yep.
As Matt and Mike retake their places, we will await that performance. I want to remind all of our listeners that WKAR in Current State is bidding farewell to one of MSU's own Pamela Witten, Dean of the Michigan State University College of Communication Arts and Sciences, has been named the University of Georgia Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs and University Provost. Dr. Witten's new position is effective February 1st. In addition to her appointment as provost, Pam Witten will hold tenured faculty appointments jointly in three departments, telecommunications, health policy, and communication. Witten started her career at Michigan State in 1998 as an assistant professor in the Department of Telecommunication, Information Studies, and Media, and held numerous positions here at MSU. Under Pam's leadership, WKAR Radio and TV developed many new initiatives and programs, including this show, Current State. Pam's passion for sports is well known to all her colleagues and friends. Last April, Pam organized the college's Spartan Sports Journalism Classic. Pam took that opportunity to join us on Current State to discuss the Sports Journalism Classic and her enthusiasm for all things sports.
Certainly, it's the joy of the competition, but it's also just the fun of, you know, people pushing themselves, you know, to limits that they don't know that they can necessarily do. And for those of us that don't necessarily have the physical ability to match those skills, to live vicariously through the fun of all the sports, and, you know, to get to second guess. I mean, it's the joy of the judgment in sports as well. That's so much fun.
That's our show for today. Good luck, Pam. Back to Mike Teeger and Matt Borgi playing us out on Current State on WKAR.